Da lytter du til en podcast ifra Damaris Norge. Har du lyst til å støtte arbeidet til Damaris, som for eksempel denne podcasten her, da kan du gå inn på damaris.no, så finner du informasjon om hvordan du kan støtte oss der. Her dagens podcast.
We do wish everyone welcome to this webinar on Richard Dawkins versus the case for God. A critical guide with the guest Peter S. Williams. Now, this lecture is a part of our course in communication and worldviews at NLA University College. And it's actually a part of our three open webinar lectures in a series. While a lot of what we're doing in this course in apologetics is giving positive arguments for the Christian faith, specifically focusing on arguments for God's existence and arguments for the resurrection of Jesus. These webinars takes the critical stance to the alternatives, and both this constructive part of giving good reasons for the Christian faith and the critical approach to the alternatives are part of the task of good apologetics. Now, our lecturer today is Peter S. Williams. He is a philosopher. He is a quite a prolific author. He has authored several books and been engaged in several others. He is a part of the Faculty of Communications and Worldviews at NLA University College and has been so for quite a few years. He's also contributing to our academic journal, Theophilos. Find it on theophilos.no, where there are articles and material in both Scandinavian languages and also in English. Now, Peter S. Williams, he is in many ways a specialist on Dawkins and the New Atheism. You've written several books, and many of them focus on New Atheism, or at least touch on them. And your latest book, Peter, was a response book to the youth version of Richard Dawkins' God Delusion. So you might mention that during your lecture. Now we look forward to listening to your lecture on Richard Dawkins versus the case for God, a critical guide. You're welcome.
Thank you for joining us, everyone. So I'm assuming you've joined because you know a little bit about Richard Dawkins, but maybe I'll fill out some background here. Professor Dawkins is a fellow of the Royal Society, Institute of Scientists in the UK, and a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, indeed, as well. He's a good writer. He's one of the so-called new or neo-atheists. He's a zoologist by training and is an emeritus fellow of New College, Oxford. And he was the University of Oxford's first professor for public understanding of science between 1995 and 2008. But he first came to prominence through his popular science books for the general public, such as The Blind Watchmaker in 1986 and Climbing Mount Improbable in 1996. But as the years went on, his atheism, indeed, I think we could describe it as anti-theism, came more to the fore in his writing, television appearances and so on. And with the best-selling book, The God Delusion, that sold over 3 million copies since it was published first in 2006. And there was also a 10th anniversary edition in 2016. And recently in 2019, he published a book dealing with very similar themes, or not identical themes, and aimed at a younger audience of sort of older teenagers, I would say, called Outgrowing God, Beginner's Guide to Atheism. As Bjorn very kindly mentioned, I recently published a book called Outgrowing God? A Beginner's Guide to Richard Dawkins and the God Debate, which is a direct response to Dawkins' book and follows the form of following a narrative about a group of students in a book club reading Dawkins' book. And that allows me to to write this book in a dialogue form with different characters representing different viewpoints, engaging with Dawkins's ideas. So let me start off by mentioning that there is a far broader range of theistic arguments, of arguments for God, than most people realize, including Richard Dawkins. The American Christian philosopher Alvin Plantinga once was in his paper, which he outlined what he called a couple of dozen or so theistic arguments, a paper that was recently turned into an academic conference and then a book of conference proceedings, which you might like to look into if you want to delve into some high-level philosophy. In his best-selling book, The God Delusion, Dawkins devotes just 37 pages to looking at the issue of the arguments for God, to rejecting 10 theistic arguments that he looks at. So even if his critique of those 10 theistic arguments were correct, which they're not, then he would not have refuted the case for God, because there's a lot more arguments out there that he simply doesn't deal with. For example, of 9 theistic arguments in the monumental Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology, only 5 of the arguments, those 9 arguments that appear in that book, are dealt with by Dawkins in The God Delusion. Let's start a little look at what we can call the organic version of the design argument. This is an argument that Dawkins takes very seriously, and it's kind of at the forefront of his thinking, because it's, he says, when he first found out about the Darwinian explanation for the apparent design of life, that he gave up on the last vestiges of his childhood belief in God. We need to think here about issues about assigning the burden of proof with what British philosopher Richard Swinburne calls the principle of credulity, that is the principle of when to trust. And Swinburne outlines that it's a basic principle of knowledge, which he calls the principle of credulity, that we ought to believe that things are as they seem to be to us until we have sufficient evidence that we're mistaken. And Swinburne points out that if we didn't do this, if we're doing the reverse, we'd say we'd never believe anything until we have sufficient evidence that we're right. But then, of course, we'd never believe that evidence that we're right really was real evidence and really showed that we were right, unless we had evidence for that, and so on and so on and so on. And we'd have this sort of infinite demand for evidence that we could never satisfy. So you have to start arguing from somewhere in order to argue to anywhere. And Swinburne says the place to start is with things that seem to us to be true, and we believe those things until and unless we've got reason to think we're mistaken. In other words, we could boil this down to the principle that, you know, if it looks like a duck, it's probably a duck, right? Until someone gives us sufficient reason to think that we're mistaken. Himself in The Blind Watchmaker said that biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. So we have here a sort of intuitive design argument, a very intuitive design argument, where we say that we ought to believe that things are as they seem to be until we've got evidence that we're mistaken. Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose, from which we can draw the conclusion that therefore we ought to believe that biology is the study of things that were designed for a purpose until we have sufficient evidence that we're mistaken. And of course, Dawkins thinks that we do have sufficient evidence to think that we're mistaken about that. And he spends a lot of time in his writings discussing this. I also want to bring in an issue about what's called specified complexity, and this notion of specified complexity. Dawkins himself talks about this in a number of places. In The God Delusion, he says that you and I and every other living creature are machines of ineffable complexity, but it's not just complexity or unlikeliness. He says ineffable complexity of a magnitude to challenge our credulity, and he defines what he means here complexity here means statistical improbability in a non-random direction. So it's not just improbability. Improbability in a non-random direction, i.e. the direction of that seems designed for a purpose. So complexity of achieving a purpose. Dawkins acknowledges that specified complexity is a plausible indicator of design. So in an article in Free Inquiry magazine, Dawkins wrote that specified complexity takes care of the sensible point that, you know, in the unique disposition of its parts, a pile of detached watch parts, as we have in one of the pictures here, tossed around in a box. That's any of those sort of arrangements of bits of watch tossed around in a box would be as improbable, i.e. complex, as a fully functioning, genuinely complicated, as he calls it, watch. He says, what is specified about a watch in the other picture is that it is improbable in the specific direction of telling the time. So it's not just that you've got a complicated arrangement of parts, any old arrangement of watch parts would be complicated, but when you have a complicated arrangement of parts that achieves this function, that hits this sort of independent pattern, a pattern you haven't just read off the existence of the parts themselves, well then that is, in our experience, on a uniform experience, a reliable indicator of design. Or to pick another example from Dawkins' own works, in The Blind Watchmaker, he talks about coming across, the example of coming across an unlocked safe with a combination lock on it. And he says, look, you know, of all the equally improbable positions of the combination lock, that's complexity, only one opens the lock specification. So you have to put in a series of numbers of a certain length to open the safe, but not any series of numbers of that length will open the safe. Now, any series of numbers of that particular length will be just as unlikely to happen by chance as any other, in a sense. You know, they're all one possible combination of those numbers of that length out of all of the possible combinations of numbers of that length. But only one is specified as achieving this goal of being opening the safe. And when we come across an open safe, we should reckon that, you know, somebody knew the combination is a much better explanation than someone got lucky. So again, that's a sort of tongue-in-cheek. So this is Dawkins's design argument, premise, specified complexity as a reliable indicator of design. Second premise, nature contains specified complexity. Well, if those are both true, again, it follows that nature contains a reliable indicator of design. And actually, Dawkins seems to affirm both premises of this logically valid argument. But of course, he disagrees with the conclusion, and we'll come on to why. Well, Darwinism, or specifically neo-Darwinism, has quite a lot to do with it. Dawkins says the complexity, i.e. the specified complexity of living bodies, indeed of every one of its trillion cells, is so mind-shattering to anyone who truly grasps it. He talks about the temptation to buckle at the knees and succumb to a non-explanation, as he thinks of it, is almost overwhelming. But, he says, humanity's best estimate of the probability, the complexity of divine creation, dropped steeply in 1859 when The Origin of Species was published, and it has declined steadily during the subsequent decades as evolution consolidated itself from a plausible theory in the 19th century to established fact today. Well, here I have to raise the caveat that evolution actually means many things. It can be defined in many separate ways or as containing many separate claims, and it's possible to believe some of the claims that go under the label of evolution without believing all of them. You can believe all of them, you can believe none of them, you can believe some of them. And one has to ask what are the specific claims and what you think of each one. Indeed, except evolution different senses, You could accept all the points labeled here in green about the earth being ancient and life having changed over time and common ancestry and even universal common ancestry. None of that means you necessarily have to believe the blind watchmaker hypothesis that the pattern of life forms related via common ancestry is the result of an unguided and unplanned process of random variation and natural selection, or the naturalistic origins hypothesis that life arose from non-life by virtue of an unguided, unplanned process, and so on. Indeed, Charles Darwin's own theory of evolution by natural selection only embraced the hypotheses here in green and not the ones in black. Dawkins says it's Darwin who patiently tells us exactly how the trick of life works. This appearance of design is a trick, and the key to solving the puzzle, as it were, to seeing through the trick, is cumulative natural selection. In The Origin of Species, I think we see Darwin reversing the proper burden of proof concerning design to award the presumption of truth to his bold but risky extrapolation from observed microevolution to macroevolution, saying evolution can do these little things that we can observe. Maybe let's assume it can do lots. It can do everything over enough time. That extrapolation depended crucially upon an unwarranted shift between saying that he saw no barrier to the extrapolation and saying there was, in fact, no barrier. And that shift constitutes an argument from ignorance. So here's a quote from The Origin of Species. You know, if we have under nature variability and a powerful agent, natural selection, as you would call it, always ready to act and to select, why should we doubt that variation in any way useful to beings would be preserved, accumulated, and inherited? What limit can be put on this power acting during long ages, favoring the good, what works, and rejecting the bad, what doesn't work? I can see no limit to this power in slowly and beautifully adapting each form. But then, of course, he jumps to the conclusion that there is no limit and awards his theory the assumption of truth and puts the burden of proof on the skeptic. I think that reverses the burden of proof established by the appearance of design that even Dawkins himself acknowledges. So Dawkins talks about Mount Improbable in his book, Climbing Mount Improbable, as this analogy for the complexity of life and getting it by not jumping from, you know, no life to getting all the complexity we see around us in one step, but breaking it down into little gradual steps over time, a gradual route to the top of Mount Improbable around the back. So hence the analogy of climbing Mount Improbable. He says, however daunting the sheer cliffs that the adaptive mountain first presents, graded ramps can be found the other side and the peak eventually scaled by this cumulative process of selection. Well, question, how does Dawkins know that these graded ramps can be found without actually finding them? Because he says, without staring from our chair, we can see that it must be so because nothing except gradual accumulation could in principle do the job. Really? What job? The job of explaining life without mentioning design. It's obvious that gradual accumulation, natural selection, is not the only possible explanation, which therefore must be true, because Dawkins is arguing for the blind watchmaker thesis as an alternative better explanation than design. So what's going on here is actually Dawkins is begging the question in favour of macroevolution and against design. He says in one quote from a YouTube video, there cannot have been intermediate stages that were not beneficial in this graded route. There's got to be a series of advantages all the way. If you can't think of one, that's your problem, not natural selection's problem. Natural selection, well, you know, I suppose that's a thought of matter of faith on my part, since the theory is so coherent and powerful. But as atheists like Jerry Fodor and Massimo Piattelli and Palomini here say in their book, What Darwin Got Wrong, They say, we don't know what the mechanism of evolution is. As far as we can make out, nobody knows exactly how phenotypes evolve. I would think that Dawkins' appeal to neo-Darwinism to explain how phenotypes evolve also is actually a red herring. Now, this is an interesting English phrase that philosophers use to describe a particular fallacy of thinking. Let me explain it, what a red herring is. A red herring is, well, a herring cured in, by salting and slow smoking to a dark brown colour. But it's also used because there was a practice of drawing a red herring across a trail to confuse hunting dogs so that they would go after the red herring rather than, you know, the fox that they were hunting or so on, in order to save the fox from the hunters. It's something that distracts our attention from the real issue. So I think this appeal to Darwinism, whatever you make of it, is actually something of a distraction from the real issue. Because, for example, concerning the origin of life able to undergo evolution, Dawkins' appeal to natural selection is a completely irrelevant distraction. As the atheist philosopher of science, Bradley Montan, says, Darwinian evolution only comes into play once life already exists. Darwinian evolution doesn't explain or even purport, even try to explain how life came to arise in the first place. Atheist Thomas Nagel, again, in his book, Mind and Cosmos, argues he thinks the origin of life remains a mystery, an event to which no significant probability can be assigned on the basis of what we know of the laws of physics and chemistry. So, you know, even if you think neo-Darwinism is a completely sufficient explanation for what it purports to explain, it doesn't get us out of the issue of design of life. Because where did life itself come from? And indeed, for life to exist, we have to exist in a finely tuned universe that is such that life can exist. Such a universe turns out to be finely tuned, as cosmologists have discovered in a few decades. So Dawkins himself says the laws and constants of physics are fine-tuned in such a way as to set up the conditions under which peacocks and humans and so on come into existence. Fine-tuned, that's complexity, in such a way as to, that's specification, be life-permitting. We've got complexity and specification, and that would seem to indicate design. Against this, Dawkins will appeal to the so-called multiverse hypothesis. I won't say very much about this now. We talked with students about this quite a lot earlier today, but Dawkins appeals to the multiverse, saying, you know, there are billions of universes having different laws and constants. Of course, we could only find ourselves in one of the minority of universes whose laws and constants happen to be propitious to our evolution, happen to allow our evolution. A lot could be said about this, but here I'll just simply note that scientific appeals to a multiverse are question-begging themselves, because they assume the existence of a finely tuned universe-generating mechanism. As the agnostic cosmologist Paul Davis writes in his book, The Goldilocks Enigma, multiverse theories merely shift the problem up a level from the universe to the multiverse. There has to be a, turns out to be finely tuned, universe-generating mechanism. The multiverse theory, therefore, cannot provide a complete and final explanation of why the universe is fit for life. When it comes down to it, the kind of the key plank in Dawkins' attempt to get around this design issue, particularly in the God Delusion book, is a philosophical, a metaphysical argument against design. And here's his first attempt to defend this philosophical rejection of design. He says, if you're trying to explain something improbable, like life or the universe is fine-tuning, if you're trying to explain something improbable, it can never satisfy to invoke an entity that is in itself at least as improbable as the thing you're trying to explain. In other words, you're trying to explain A, you can't explain A by appealing to B if B is more complicated, more improbable than A. Question, do we make any explanatory advance in our understanding if we explain this complex self-portrait in terms of the more complex existence of Edvard Munch? It seems to me that we do. So this rule of explanation that Dawkins appeals to just seems to be obviously wrong. Indeed, the American philosopher William Lane Craig says that in order for an explanation to be the best explanation, one needn't have an explanation of the explanation. Such a requirement would generate an infinite regress so that everything becomes inexplicable. Dawkins is arguing that we should reject explanations more complex than the data they explain. But note this, Dawkins is more complex than the words he uses to make this argument. So by his own rule of explanation, he and we shouldn't believe that he is arguing for his rule of explanation or arguing against the fine-tuning argument. But that's self-contradictory. Here's a second way in which Dawkins tries to metaphysically rebut the design inference. He says the designer himself, in order to be capable of designing, would have to be another complex, i.e. unlikely, entity of the kind that, in his turn, needs the same kind of explanation. You'd be getting into an infinite regress of designers. Thinks Dawkins, and infinite regresses are to be avoided, which I would agree with him about. He says, critics of my book tried to deny that a god capable of designing something complex must himself be complex. Well, why think God must be complex rather than simple, say? Well, Dawkins points out that God has to be clever enough to calculate the exact values of the physical constants that would find you in the universe. You call that simple? God has enough bandwidth to listen to the prayers and praises of billions of people simultaneously. You know, the one thing he cannot be, if he's to match even minimally to his job description, is simple. Well, take this reply from the agnostic philosopher Sir Anthony Kenny, who, in conversation with Dawkins, distinguished what he called complexity of structure from what he called complexity of function. And he gave a nice illustration of this distinction. He said, look, the electric razor basically only be used to cut a beard, but the cutthroat razor might also be used to cut a throat, etc., or open your mail with, and so on. Of course, the cutthroat razor is a lot more simple in its structure than the electric razor, but the simpler object can nonetheless do more things. It has more complexity of function. It can achieve more results than the very complex electric razor. So here that Kenny is making is that an argument demonstrating a complexity of function doesn't thereby necessarily demonstrate the existence of a complexity of structure. But of course, what Dawkins needs to show is that God, if he were to exist, would have a complexity of structure, not merely a complexity of function. But all his argument shows is a complexity of function, not a complexity of structure. Dawkins' only reply to Kenny was, I really don't see what you're saying. Well, none of Dawkins' observations is an argument showing that to fulfill his job description, God must be complex and not simple in the relevant technical senses. Dawkins, in other words, equivocates, is ambiguous between the terms, the meaning of the terms complex and simple. And he equivocates in order to beg the question against God being a simple or necessary being. He's just assuming that God would exhibit a complexity that points to an external explanation, a complex, contingent, unlikely arrangement of parts, Because remember, that's what points us to design, this unlikely contingent arrangement of parts that happens to hit an independent pattern. Well, even if one were to argue that God would contain some complexity, that wouldn't show that God himself required an explanation, i.e. God may have an essential nature that exists necessarily and which explains any complexity it contains. That is, Dawkins is here equivocating between what we might call the mind of God and the contents of the mind of God. You know, there might be, maybe, specified complexity within the mind of God. And yes, that would require an explanation, but you can't say that gets us into an infinite regress without begging the question against saying, and the explanation of that specified complexity in the mind of God is the mind of God, which is a necessarily existent metaphysical reality. So as William Lane Craig comments, Dawkins has evidently confused a mind's ideas, which may indeed be complex, with a mind itself, which is an incredibly simple entity. Interacting with Dawkins on this issue of design ends up in the end, I think, being a little bit analogous to listening to a conversation that might go a little bit like this. Question. Don't you think that the existence of this music suggests the existence of a composer? Answer. No. A composer would have a mind containing the music, and probably other music, and even many random arrangements of notes too. The composer explanation is just too complex. Maybe so many arrangements of notes exist somewhere that I can't show you, that we shouldn't be surprised to have chanced upon one that's musical. Yeah, question in response. But wouldn't lots of music in a mind just be more evidence for a mind? And don't even random strings of notes need an explanation for their existence? And so the conversation might go on. To a different argument, the mathematical moral argument, and then we'll close. Dawkins says there's also the moral version of what he calls the God temptation. A moral argument might be put something like this. Premise, if objective moral values were to exist, then it would seem a good explanation that God exists. And by objective moral values here, we mean objective in the sense of the kind of things that we discover rather than invent, that don't depend upon us. Premise two, if you could say that objective moral values do exist, well, then it would follow that therefore a God exists. Because when you think about it, what would an objective moral fact or an objective moral value be? We seem to be talking about a realm of sort of the morally ideal. An ideal seems to imply intentionality, something that prescribes or commands our behavior. It's not something that's merely descriptive, and it's something that obligates our behavior. We're obligated to behave and not to behave in certain ways by moral facts. But an intentional idea or character seems to require a mind, and prescription or a command requires a prescriber or a commander. And obligation seems to require someone to whom one is rightfully obligated. So objective moral facts seem to point to a personal reality that grounds their existence. Here's Dawkins on the moral argument. He says, you know, without God, it is said, where's the inducement to be good? What are the sanctions against bad behavior? And he complains about basing moral decisions on the fear that our every move is being watched, so we need to suck it up to an obsessively vigilant God who's inexhaustibly interested in what goes on in our beds. I think Dawkins here is just misinformed about the inner dynamics of Christian ethics, and again, this is all another red herring. It's all irrelevant. It doesn't address the argument that we just laid out. Dawkins says, how do we even know what is good and what's bad? The temptation here is to abdicate the responsibility to think about morality and just take the lazy route of slavishly following an ancient book of rules invented by fallible men. So he assumes. Again, this is another irrelevant red herring. The meta-ethical moral argument isn't about explaining how we know what's good and bad. It's about explaining how come good and bad are objective realities that exist to be known, however we know them. Indeed, the Bible, St. Paul in the letter to Romans, says that when Gentiles, when non-Jews, who don't have the law, you know, in the Old Testament scriptures, when they do by nature things required by the law, they're a law for themselves, since they show that the requirements of the law, the moral law, are written on their hearts. So the official biblical position is that you don't need to know anything about the Bible in order to know about right and wrong. But that's not the issue here anyway. So actually, when it comes down to it, in the face of the moral argument, what Dawkins really does is to deny the truth of premise two. Here is a fascinating quote from Dawkins where he says that there is a non-overlapping and exhaustive distinction between ideas that are false or true about the real world, factual matters in the broad sense, matters that he would give the power of deciding to science to tell us about. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, he says there are ideas about what we ought to do, normative or moral ideas for which the words true and false have no meaning. Normative or moral ideas for which the words true and false have no meaning. But Dawkins also says that Hitler and Stalin were, by any standards, spectacularly evil men. Well, not by their own standards. What do you mean by objectively true standards of morality? Well, no, because terms about what's good and bad, normative terms, don't have any meaning. So literally, Dawkins tells us that he doesn't mean what he says here. Nor does he mean what he says when he says that faith is an evil, precisely because it requires no justification and brooks no argument. And I hope the existence of this lecture itself shows that faith does brook argument, indeed invites it. But beside the point, Dawkins is wanting to criticize faith, religious faith, as an evil thing. On the one hand, and yet on the other hand, he also tells us that he thinks that moral terms have no meaning. So despite rejecting the objective existence of moral values, Dawkins is constantly criticizing the evils of religion, thereby contradicting himself. In conclusion, Dawkins doesn't address many theistic arguments. But the ones he does address, I think he addresses poorly. He follows Darwin in making an argument from ignorance in the face of the organic design argument. But actually his response to the organic design argument is an irrelevant red herring. His response to the fine-tuning design argument is question begging. His argument against complex explanations is self-contradictory and obviously wrong for other reasons. He equivocates between complexity of function and structure in arguing against the appeal to God to explain cosmic design. Equivocates between a mind and the ideas in a mind. He begs the question again against God being a necessary being. Dawkins's response to the meta-ethical moral argument is full of irrelevant red herrings again, talking off issue. And his rejection of objective moral values actually seems to contradict his own critique of the evils of religion, many of which I would actually want to say that there actually are evils of religion, or certainly evils of religious people. But if there are evils of religious people, that means there are evils, and we are back to facing the moral argument. Which is to say that his critique of the evils of religion contradicts his critique of the moral argument, and he can't have it both ways. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Pete. This was very helpful, and a lot of material. And you know, of course, you know Richard Dawkins very well by interacting with his material on many, many, many occasions. And you showed us some of this, and given your an incisive critique. Now there are some helpful questions here coming up, I encourage people to add on their questions as well. Just a couple of questions from the start. Richard Dawkins is an immensely popular figure, and why is that? How come Richard Dawkins has become so popular, maybe especially by people who think they're intellectual?
Yeah, well, Dawkins is certainly a bright guy. I mean, you don't get to be an emeritus professor at Oxford University for nothing, right? And he carries the sort of cachet of being a scientist and being a scientist who's worked at Oxford. And he is known to the public through writing very well-selling popular science books and making media appearances. He writes well. He's got a good turn of phrase, and he communicates well in person as well. So the media like having him on news programs or to host science programs and so on. He's done a lot of that over the years. So he's been given a platform by the media because of his eloquence, because of the cachet of his job and his background. But unfortunately, when he's talking about issues in the philosophy of religion or theology, he is talking outside of his professional expertise, and he unfortunately doesn't seem to put a lot of effort into learning that expertise in an extracurricular manner either. So he regularly makes these kind of mistakes in reasoning, fallacies of reasoning, that one would hope that, you know, undergraduate philosophy students who've actually attended their lectures and paid attention would be able to note, like, oh, he's begging the question there, or he's contradicting himself, or what have you. But Dawkins doesn't, and not everybody has that background training, and so, you know, people don't notice and sort of take him at his word because of his credentials.
Richard Dawkins is not very popular among all atheists. He's been under quite sharp criticism of some really strong and intellectual atheists. Could you mention some of those critiques?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, not all atheists are new atheists. Atheists take different approaches to many different issues, just like Christians take different approaches to many different issues, although we have things in common as well. So there are atheists who feel embarrassed by Richard Dawkins and think Richard Dawkins is the kind of atheist who gives atheism a bad name, or find some of his comments on Twitter. Dawkins has gained a bit of a reputation for saying controversial things on Twitter. We don't need to go into particular examples of whether we agree or disagree with this or that example, but he's certainly a controversial, outspoken figure. And being outspoken can be controversial. He doesn't represent, you know, all atheists or how all atheists think about things. And I wouldn't want to, you know, paint atheists all with the same brush, as it were. But his ideas do need engagement because, as you say, he is a very popular representative and a very influential representative of atheism. His, you know, media appearances, his books sell a lot. So a lot of people are being influenced by this type of atheism. And so it needs addressing in the public square.
So you mentioned one famous atheist, which gives a critique.
Mm. Yeah.
Thomas Nagel, you mentioned.
Thomas Nagel, that I mentioned, is an atheist who would be critical. Michael Ruse is a philosopher of science, who's an agnostic, skeptic philosopher in the States, who's very critical of Dawkins. Terry Eagleton, atheist philosopher called Eric Weilenberg, published a philosophy paper critiquing the central argument by Richard Dawkins in The God Delusion, saying it was not an impressive argument. One could go on.
It's interesting that he's quite heavily critiqued in academia, so people want to distance themselves from him if you're an academic. A little bit like popular Christian preachers who are not kind of really popular, credible in the academic culture. He's got a lot of critiques and questions and challenges to some of his arguments. Would you say that he has changed any of his kind of basic views or perspectives since The God Delusion in his latest book, Outgrowing God?
No, I don't think so. Outgrowing God is very much a sort of take two of The God Delusion, written for a younger audience. It covers a slightly different range of issues, but it'll all be sort of a familiar genre to you if you've read The God Delusion. So he criticizes the morality of various biblical stories and characters. Mm-hmm. He's critical of the search for the historical Jesus. He's skeptical about the possibility of miracles. He argues against, you know, there are no good arguments for God, and tends to make these kind of logical fallacies and misunderstandings even of what the arguments are that he critiques. So he tends to talk off topic, etc. Yeah,
we had another very interesting question here in the Q&A, and you'd probably know this. It's kind of a personal question about Dawkins. Are there any personal reasons that you know of why Dawkins is so critical towards the Christian faith?
I think this is a tricky question because I don't know him personally. I know him through his writings. And I think it's important in academic conversation and in apologetics to critique people's arguments rather than the people themselves. One would risk falling into what's called the ad hominem, the against the person fallacy of arguing against a person rather than against a person's views. Whether or not his arguments are good arguments is a separate issue from whether or not he has good or bad motives for putting forward those arguments, for example. And just as you wouldn't want atheists to criticize a Christian apologist by critiquing the person rather than their arguments, you know, the apologist may turn out to be a hypocrite, which is terrible and sad and to be lamented. But that doesn't mean that the arguments that they made were necessarily bad arguments. Those same arguments could be made by an apologist with high integrity of character just as well. So I tend to try and just focus on the arguments and leave issues of, you know, why, the broader issues of why someone holds an opinion. Well, we can leave that for the psychologists and the sociologists and so on.
But you know, one thing is the content of the argument. The other one is the kind of the hostility in the style. Do you have any comments on that? This could be a cultural thing, a personal thing, or because he's very confrontative and hostile.
He is combative. I mean, he calls on people to ridicule religion and religious people. But this is a sort of deliberate tactic. He says being respectful gives the false idea that what you're critiquing has some legitimacy to it because you're being respectful of it. Whereas if you just, you know, just laugh them out of court, don't treat them seriously because they don't deserve it. And I think this kind of approach backfires on him, really, because he doesn't take theology or philosophy seriously, he doesn't learn about it sufficiently to accurately engage with it. And then he ends up talking off topic or making simple mistakes of reasoning in engaging with it. And that undermines his, you know, credibility the credibility of what he's saying. Whereas, of course, as we said, you know, there are other atheists who would, on the one hand, critique Dawkins's arguments and perhaps his style, and would have a different style, and may, you know, as they would think, have better arguments. Again, just as you can't dismiss the case for God by reading what Richard Dawkins has to say about a very small subset of them, neither can you dismiss atheism by saying, oh, Richard Dawkins doesn't make good arguments for atheism or against belief in God, you know, therefore no one should be an atheist. You know, it's never as straightforward and simple as that, is it?
Mm-hmm. So what are your favorite arguments for the existence of God, or maybe what would might be slightly difficult, different question. What arguments for the existence of God do you find that people mostly resonate with today?
Gosh, yeah, I think this is varies from person to person. I think there are a very wide range of arguments for God. I mentioned the two dozen or so arguments book, and I think there may be more arguments than that. There are lots of connections between God and the reality around us that we can unearth, and people can often appreciate those connections at an intuitive level, but then you can cash them out at a sort of philosophical level. And different people will be interested, or sort of their imaginations caught by different aspects of that overall case. It's really the overall accumulation of arguments that has the most powerful effect. But if you want to focus on individual arguments or types of arguments, someone who is really interested in the sciences may indeed be more caught up with, more impressed by, engaged with arguments that have premises that have to do with science, like the Big Bang or the fine-tuning of the universe or the information content of DNA or all sorts of areas. But that may leave other people cold, but they may be engaged by things like the moral argument that we discussed about, or, you know, C.S. Lewis's versions of the argument from desire. Do we have inbuilt desires that point beyond this reality and point to the existence of God as the necessary condition of the fulfillment of these desires for transcendence? What about our experience of beauty in the world? What is beauty? Is that something that's objective and that points to God? You know, maybe someone who's really interested in arts might be more interested in those kind of arguments, from sort of existential concerns and from beauty and so on, than arguments to do with cosmic fine tuning. So I think it's finding what will connect with people most and to focus there.
Mm. Yes, and of course you also have the issue of the story of Jesus, the person of Jesus.
Right.
You've written on that as well. Yeah,
I have indeed. Mm. I wrote a book called Getting at Jesus, mm-hmm. A comprehensive critique of neo-atheist nonsense about the Jesus of history, mm-hmm. Which really tried to do exactly what it says on the dust cover, and engaged with and used neo-atheist views on the historical Jesus as a launching off point for investigating the historical Jesus, and particularly focusing on the issue of the argument for the resurrection of Jesus, mm-hmm. how people's philosophical assumptions affect what they would make of that kind of historical investigation of Jesus, mm-hmm. and how it would close them to or open them to that investigation. So dealing with the prior philosophical issues so that we can get at the historical Jesus historically. What can we know about in particular? What data can we establish that pertains to the resurrection of Jesus? And then how do we go about, you know, arguing what's the best explanation of that evidence in terms of just standard historical explanatory criteria of explaining things?
Thank you very much. Just the final question, and thank you for everyone who's been participating and putting up questions here. Where should we look for material, maybe on the popular level here, on Dawkins and his atheism?
Sure. So there's plenty of YouTube material you can find. I know that through the college, there's a version of the Dawkins's discussion with John Lennox, who's a Christian mathematician and philosopher from Oxford, that they had in 2007. And you've put Norwegian subtitles to that discussion. So that's very accessible for a Norwegian audience to look at. And then you'd find a range of materials at different levels, say through my website at peterswilliams.com, which will, you know, tell you about my books and so on, but give you access to free articles and lists of YouTube videos, podcasts, etc. That lots of them deal with different aspects of the neo-atheist movement and of Dawkins in particular.
And of course, we recommend your book, The Outgrown God? Which is also written for youth groups, for youth.
So to the same sort of, I would say sort of older teens to undergraduate sort of spread of age groups that Dawkins has aimed his own recent book at. Yeah.
So I think this was a good opportunity to make use of a very important voice in the modern media, and to look critically at it, and to open up question and discussion about these really big questions that even Richard Dawkins is addressing, and showing that both his critique of the Christian faith and Christian ideas are failing, and his own perspectives are really both contradictive. Self-contradicting and problematic.
Yeah.
So I think we can encourage people to explore and reflect and use this material for discussion among ourselves and even in schools. And that's why we've written a discussion guide to the Dawkins and Lennox debate, the Alabama debate. You find it on YouTube. That can be kind of a starting point for helping people, maybe especially these young adults you mentioned, helping them analyze the argument and seeing that there are good, very good responses and good critiques to be delivered, because those critiques are very seldom heard in popular culture. Mm. It's a good opportunity for us to be a part of that discussion. Yes, so thank you very much, Peter. We look forward to working with you for the future. Thank you for this session, and God bless.